So good morning. I want to thank Scott for that warm introduction and thank the board and thank all of you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a beautiful place. It was a beautiful ride up here. And my name's Pete, and I'm a grateful recovering member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Alateen and Al-Anon. And my home group is Early Risers in Birmingham, and what's really special about that group is it's a step study and tradition study. And so whatever month we're in, that's the step we do for 3 weeks, and then we do the tradition on the fourth week, and then once a quarter, we do three of the 12 concepts of service on the fifth Saturday. And so we get to start over. And so one of the things that I've learned that's helpful to me, and I'm sure it's probably true for most of you, is that practicing 12 steps is a way of living. And I didn't do step one once. I have to do step one a lot. And it's really powerful to start over again in January. So, you know, what I'm going to do today, if I can, is tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And what happened and what I'm like now will probably be woven together, because to me, as I said, it's an ongoing process. If I'm spiritually fit and spiritually connected to my higher power, then I'm in a good place. And if I'm back into ego and self, then I'm not in a good place. And I have a daily choice where I'm going to be. And sometimes I find that choice is not just daily, it can be minute by minute. I want to start by doing a reading out of One Day at a Time, which was the original Al-Anon reader. It's December 22nd, and I like this because it has a lot of themes in it that are important to me. Al-Anon has many treasures for me if I'm willing to accept them, but none can do more for me than learning really to live in the present. That means being more aware of myself and of small happy things that often dramatize themselves into importance as I observe them with enjoyment. No matter how grim the situation may be that has troubled all my waking thoughts, there are shining nuggets of pleasure all around me to distract me from my cares. But I must be on the lookout for them so they will not be lost to me. The noted scientist Huxley said it this way: for every man, the world is as fresh as it was the first day and is full of untold novelties for him who has the eyes to see them. This is a constructive and rewarding way to achieve the detachment so often mentioned in Al-Anon. And the saying is, God make me receptive and aware and restore to me my capacity for wonder. So when I think back on the family disease of Al-Anon and some of the ways it manifested itself in me, one way is just like those horses on a carriage with blinders on, and I would be focused on whatever problem, issue, fear, anxiety I had, and I couldn't see anything else. And that reading reminds me that, you know, we're on a vast planet, if I really think about it, right? There's this planet we're on with a molten core and a magnetic field that keeps us from being fried, jettisoning through space. There's light that if I look up at night that's been going through the cosmos for 5 million years before it gets to me. And I'm just this tiny, tiny, tiny little thing. But gosh, if you leave it to me, I'm the center of the universe. And it's all about me. In fact, Ray told me that, you know, one of the nice things is there's these beautiful windows and that the light can shine through. And so I was expecting great sun and there'd be this wonderful light and you could hear my brilliance and see the brilliance. And that doesn't happen. So it's all about me, right? Why is it cloudy? But I can be that way and think that way. So I grew up the oldest of four. In a house, we didn't want for anything material. We weren't rich, but we had clothes. We all got to go to college if we wanted to. and, you know, had things. I didn't get the horse I wanted, and I didn't get the motorcycle I wanted, but I didn't want for anything significant. But there was something in growing up in that household, and the family disease of alcoholism runs through my family, where somehow I got the idea as a little kid that I was really responsible for things that I wasn't responsible for. And that really gave me a sense of arrogance and powerfulness. And there was also this fear, because I was responsible for things I didn't know how to do, and I didn't know how to who to ask. And so when you couple sort of intellectual arrogance with overwhelming fear, it's a bizarre combination. And the other thing I remember about growing up at a high level was sort of a sense of arbitrariness. If I knew that if I didn't left my shoes on the porch, that was what was going to cause the outburst, I could move my shoes. But the next day, it wasn't my shoes. Because it had nothing to do with me or what I was doing, but I, as a little kid, couldn't see that. So in Al-Anon, we have a great little just for today. It's got little sayings on it. And one of them is, just for today, I will have a program. I may not follow it exactly, but I will have it. I will save myself from two pests, hurry and indecision. And other than fear and arrogance, hurry and indecision is a way I would explain my life. So thinking back, I would procrastinate, because it had to be perfect. And then I would cram the last day, or 2 days, or 3 days to get it done. But I wasn't free from worry all the time I was procrastinating. My mind was thinking about all the things I had to do, so I wasn't enjoying the time off. It was miserable. And so that manifested itself pretty well in college. So I had a really wonderful college that I went to, and one of the things we got to do was a senior thesis. And that's a little different than showing up at 8 and taking a 2-hour exam and being done, right? You got to write it, you got to type it. And I just could not get that thing done. Now, my mother was a really loving person, and I'm grateful to have her in my life. And she was very nonviolent. She taught yoga. But after a while, she said, if you do not graduate, I was on like the 6-year plan, I will kill you. And it was sort of like, write the damn thing and be done with it. And my advisor told me that his wife was like, you know, why are you having to spoon feed that kid? You know, can't he get it done? And I was just almost unable to do it. So the way I got it done was at the last minute, I would handwrite it. This was before computers. And I would give it to this lady who was typing it for me. And then I'd go to sleep for a little bit, and then I'd wake up and edit what she typed. And I got it done. And I got it done like an hour before I was supposed to justify it. And that's the way I lived my life. I also, when I started my practice, my job, I would do the same thing. I might have a big hearing on coming up, and I would fret about it, and then I'd spend all weekend getting ready for it. And that really made me a great person to live with, right? So on the weekend, I'm supposed to be doing stuff, I'm tied up, I'm worried. And again, I didn't enjoy the free time that I was procrastinating. That was, I was full of fear, full of anxiety, but I just was so afraid of not doing it perfectly that I didn't do it. I waited till the last minute. I also was good about geographic cures. For whatever reason, I felt that where I was, there was a better place to be. And if I could just get there, I would be okay. And, you know, I'm one of those people, until recently, I was more comfortable in a hotel room than my own bedroom. It just, that was part of me. I wasn't comfortable where I was at. Probably the biggest manifestation of that geographic cure was I was in Montgomery, Alabama, and in short succession, my partner of 3 years decided without any input from me that the relationship was over and he needed to leave. The job that I liked decided they could find someone else to do it better than me, and my mother got terminal cancer, and I decided to find a job in a city where I didn't know a single person. And so I wasn't able to accept help from anyone. I wasn't able to open myself up and be vulnerable to anyone. Now, my whole life wasn't all bad, but that's sort of one of the running themes through it. I felt I had to take care of things myself, and I was terribly frightened about how I was going to do them, and I felt responsible. Now, one way that I dealt with that was I drank. I drank very heavily for a long time, but I didn't have the allergy. I didn't have the obsession. I wasn't an alcoholic. So after a number of years, I think I last had a drink maybe 14 years ago, I was able to stop. And that caused problems later on when I was dealing with an alcoholic partner because I just didn't get the disease. It was like, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But that was one way I coped with it. I sort of was in denial. Other than fear and anger, I don't know that I could tell you what my feelings were. I didn't even know that I was that angry until I went to a college reunion and a friend of mine said, gosh, you were angry in high school. And I'm like, I don't even remember being that angry, but I guess I was. I knew I was fearful, but he remembered me being very angry. And as I've worked recovery, I've realized, there's feelings I have that I don't even know what they are. I need those little faces. Sort of looks like that one. So I was very disassociated from my own feelings other than fear and anger, and those were very strong. And so in the 80s, this ODAP book I read out of is a 1988 version, and my mother gave it to me new. And I didn't look at it for 20-something years. I did look at it, but if you read our literature and you don't work the program, it's sort of like, what the hell are these people talking about? But I did keep it. And, she, I think, early on realized that that she needed the help of Al-Anon and started going and suggested it to me, but did what she should do, just suggested it, and I just was not ready. So, as happens, even though I would have thought the last person in the world I'll enter into a relationship is an alcoholic, bingo, that's what I did. And I didn't know it at first. And I would go out of town. I worked out of town a lot. And I'd call home, and the calls were really weird. And so my partner at that time was binge drinking, but he would wait till I left. And then as it got a little bit worse and a little bit worse, it started happening while I was there. And I'm a very big head person, and so part of this program, as I'll talk about, has gotten me from my head to my heart. And I thought, well, and he was drinking a lot at the time. I thought, I'll wait till he's sober, because he's a medical professional, and we'll have a conversation, and I'll explain to him at the correct time that drinking half a gallon to a gallon of vodka a day is a little much. And so there was a day he was sober, and we sat down at the breakfast table, and I said, don't you think that drinking half a gallon to a gallon of vodka a day is too much? And he said, no. And I didn't know what to do, right? Because to me, it was like, this is going to be a real simple intellectual conversation. We're both going to agree, and it's going to end. And it didn't. And it was starting to get to the point where it was bothering me. I wanted to fix it. And I was recommended by a counselor that I go to Al-Anon. And so to go back, one of the things that I've learned too is you listening to me will probably know more about me at an intimate level than I would ever share with people growing up. I had friends growing up, but the last thing in the world I would tell my friends was my fears, what I was feeling, or what went on in my house. I just didn't do that. We might go ride bikes, we might go to the store, we might do, you know, play ball, but I was not going to tell you what was going on. But I did, as I grew up, if I paid someone to listen to me, I could tell them what was going on. So I was able to tell her that I'm really worried about this, and she suggested I go to Al-Anon. And I did. And when I first got there, in one of the early meetings, well, let me step back. So they started talking about powerlessness, and I did feel powerless over alcohol. I could admit that because there was no way I could stop the drinking. If being sarcastic, if being mean, if, you know, I used to, and it was really awful. There were times that we'd be having a conversation and I could understand what he was saying, but the words were being slurred and I would just say, "What? I can't understand what you're saying." I was an ass. I was mean, but I thought maybe that will get him. I don't know what I was doing. I was just angry. And I didn't like being that way. And that didn't work. And so I probably thought, well, they're going to tell me what I need to do, right? There was a better way to do it than I did it. And there's just a proper way. And if you do it the proper way, then the person you care about will quit drinking. And by that point, I had quit drinking before we met. So I was saying, well, why can't you just stop? You know, I did. Just quit picking up that bottle. And I went to Al-Anon, and I remember feeling powerless over alcohol because it was a lot. And then there were days the drinking would taper off. And I remember thinking, well, I'm not so powerless now, right? If it's three drinks, I can probably deal with it. But if it's a massive amount of drinking, it's too much. Still feeling like I had some power. I think when the powerlessness really hit me was when something that I was really afraid was going to happen happened. And so what I worried about was someone getting hurt or injured. And that's sort of my hook. That's where I get hooked in, is if I fear that someone I care about is going to hurt themselves or someone else or something bad will happen, then that gets my mind. I must step in. I must do something. I got to fix this. And so I came home one day, and on the kitchen floor was all this blood. I'm like, what the hell happened? And so I go into the bedroom, and I said, what happened? And I was told, my nose is bleeding. And I said, well, you know, are you okay? Yeah, I'm going to go to work. Well, the next morning, about 6 o'clock, it's like, can you come get me? I can't drive home. And I did. And what had happened was, it wasn't a nosebleed. He had fallen and hit his head on the overhead vent, and the headaches didn't go away. And we went to the emergency room, and the next thing I know, they're taking him to the neurointensive care unit. There's been pretty bad head injuries. And so he was in the neurointensive care unit for about 3 days, and then they let him go to a step-down unit, and he eventually came home, and one of the instructions was, don't drink with these drugs you're on. Now, you know, that stood out to me. Now, I'd been going to Al-Anon for a while, but it was like, and I really, you know, thought about it. Do I do this? Do I not do it? Well, his mom was an alcoholic too, and I was at work, and she took him home, and he wanted to stop at the liquor store, and she did, and she later said, I'm really sorry, but he asked me, and I just couldn't say no. So then there was this ongoing battle, right? I mean, to the point where I was finding bottles in the house, crazy stuff. And I remember I had this little Toyota Prius, and I probably had half gallons of vodka and some Captain Morgan rum, and when I'd turn a corner, they'd roll. Because I was trying to keep him from drinking, because the doctor said, don't drink, and if he drank, something bad was going to happen. And that's when I think that absolute powerlessness hit me. In this, it became clear to me that there is no way, if someone is bound and determined to drink, unless you're going to lock them up 24/7, that you can stop it. And I had to let go of that. And I got, I remember the first step, and they used this term surrender, and I hated that term when I first came in. Now I sort of understand it. But when I first heard it, I have this little chihuahua named Isabella, and she's tiny. But if you try to lay her on her side, there's no way you can do it. Every fiber of her being will fight you. And that's what I said when I heard the word surrender. No effing way. I didn't come here to surrender. I came here to fix this problem. And I almost left, but I didn't. Something said, all right, just let surrender go out your ear and go on. And so I continued to go to meetings. I don't know where that inner voice was, that there was something of value I would get in this program. But I went, and I started to realize I am powerless over this, and my life is unmanageable, and I am solely, I'm focusing so much time and attention on what someone else is doing, I'm really ignoring what I need to be doing. And that started to get me focused on my own recovery, but it took a while. And you know, sometimes we have to have situations that cause us to realize that we're powerless. And that one where I'm taking bottles and all that insanity was finally enough for me. This is crazy. I'm not going to be able to control this situation. And then I came to step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And that was tough because even as a little kid, and along the way, I might have said a prayer or something, but I really was sort of very arrogant. And my sponsor had me read We Agnostics in the Big Book, and I read it, and I thought of, oh, you could argue with that. The only thing that said anything to me was the italicized, where they're telling the story, and that guy gets the thing that comes to him, who are you to say there's no God? And I was at least able to say, okay, that's a valid question. Now, I did for a couple seconds think maybe I should answer that, but I did. Right? That's my calling. But that's where I was. It took, you know, seeing that question being directed to me and saying, okay, really, I don't know, right? That there is, and that's where I talked about that wonder, right? You know, because I have those blinders on. I'm the center of the universe, that it causes me to think that I am all that powerful and that important. And I remember saying in a meeting, I think I was trying to show how, you know, intellectual I was, and I was thinking about, all right, so there's this creator, but who was there before the creator? Because I can think in a sort of dimensional before, you know, what happened before that? My mind can't conceive of it. So I said something pretty arrogant, like, I think it's intellectually more easy for me to say there is no God than there is a God, and I just can't get my hands around a higher power. I can't intellectually understand this. And after the meeting, a guy named Robert, and I remember this distinctly, came up to me and said, Pete, why would you want a higher power you could intellectually understand? And it was like, bingo. I don't need to intellectually understand my higher power. And when I try to do it, all I'm really trying to do is put that power in a box that I can understand and manipulate or control, or how does it work? And it's not something I have to understand. And today, I don't have an intellectual understanding. That was sort of moving from the head to the heart. I could experience something that I didn't understand. I had to open myself up to that. And then came the thing of, you know, how do I'm not sure I believe this still, but I understand I don't have to intellectually understand it. And there's a great piece in Al-Anon literature, and I've heard it in AA meetings as well, called Acting As If. And it says, if you don't believe a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity, act as if you do. And I started to do that, and my higher power put an opportunity in front of me to practice that. And so my partner eventually decided he needed help. And I'll divert just a little bit, because it was by not intervening that decision. So there was a time his mother lived near us, and he and she were getting in a fight, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, he said, "I'm gonna go over there and confront her." And you know, part of me is like, he's really drunk. He shouldn't drive, someone should get hurt. And I'd love to say it was great Al-Anon. I said, no, let him go. It was really, I was just tired. I was like, forget it. I am not getting up and driving him at 3 a.m. The truth was, I was tired. But what happened was, about 6 or 7 a.m, I got a text from her, come get him, and I got a text from him, come get me. And we went out to breakfast, and I don't know what happened in that house, but it was the first time he ever said, we were in a Waffle House, he said, I need help. And it was great. And so there was a treatment facility up the road that was willing to take him, and we went home and got stuff, and he did, and he's been a active member and been sober for 5 years. So, but that was, again, you know, my first inclination was, I need to fix this. But whatever needed to happen in that house needed to happen for him to get to where he needed to be. So anyway, going back, while he was in treatment, his mother had had cancer surgery. Her jaw had to be taken out, and it was not going well. The new jaw that was put in, the artificial jaw, was failing. She was not doing well, and I got to be sort of the primary caretaker. And I think, looking back, what I couldn't see and what he couldn't see for a while was, she was really ready to go, but I don't think she would say that. You know, she was saying, I want to get better and I want to do this, but every indication was she's not eating, she's in a lot of pain. And so I had to work, and I would get these caregivers, and I had to dose out the medicines. And I would drive up to that house, and in my mind, you know, I wanted her to be better, and I wanted the things to have turned, and she was going to get better, and that wasn't happening. And what I started to say was the serenity prayer. You know, it worked. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. So whatever's happening in that house, whether she's in pain or eating or not eating, I can accept that. And then give me the courage to change the things I can. And one of the things that came to me was, somehow in the back of my mind, I realized this is probably getting close to the end. And the last thing I really want her to see, because I did love her and care about her, was my ass. She doesn't need to see that. And so I could ask God, help me go in that house and be loving and kind no matter what the situation is. Because I wanted it different, right? You need to get better, because it's causing me anxiety that you're sick and dying. And that's a lot of what I learned in Al-Anon, is a lot of times my discomfort with what someone else is doing is really about me. I like to think, oh, I'm just so wonderful, I have this heart of compassion towards them, but some of it is I just don't feel comfortable with someone I care about not doing well. And so I want them to fix themselves so I can feel good. But God did go in that house with me. I was able to go in that house, deal with a situation that I did not like, and be kind and gracious, and I could not have done that on my own. So I felt that presence. And then the third step, I still wasn't ready to turn my will and life over to the care of God, though I did like the care of God, you know, not the control. So I asked my sponsor at the time, well, how do I do that? And he said, take the fourth step. I said, okay, I can do that. And I did. And what was interesting in that fourth step was, there was a number of people on that list that I had resentments for, that I understood why, and I knew why I had resentments. But there were some people on that list, when I started looking at, what had they done to me? Nothing. They were better looking. They were more successful. They had things that I wanted. It was like, good God, envy is this big thing. That person has done nothing to me. They just lived their life, and I was envious, and I was resentful. And that was eye-opening to me. But I want to step back for a second. When I first came in, my best friend had died in 1995 from HIV and AIDS before there were the protease inhibitors. It was at the end of the period of time that AIDS was pretty much a death sentence before the treatments that are available today were in. And as he was dying, his sister and I would go into the hospital and take, be there with him. And I didn't like the way that she was trying to control things. And it got so bad that I realized I can't be in the hospital when she is because it's too toxic. And I remember her clomping down the hall. It was a quiet ward. And I would get up and leave. And we were good friends before this. And I had a vision one time of the elevator door opening and she stepping out and me putting my hand through her chest wall and pulling out her heart. And I'm not a violent person either, and that scared me. I mean, I was just that angry at her. So when I'm looking up at the steps on the wall and there's this 9th step about making amends, even before I'd finished the first step, I was not making amends to her. I'll do this deal, but that ain't going to happen. So part of as I'm doing the 4th step, I remember I was in a 4-step meeting, and somehow it came up that I really needed to forgive myself for hating someone so much. It came to me in a meeting, and I was able to say, okay, you know, let go of that, because I was really didn't like myself for hating her so much, and I was able to let go of that in a meeting. I remember it was at a noon meeting I attended, and that just hit me. It's like, okay, let go of that. So I did the 4th step and did the 5th step, which was an interesting experience because I said I didn't share stuff with people. So here I'm sharing with a sponsor of mine, a person that I probably wouldn't have been friends with other than he was my sponsor. You know, I don't know, know a little bit about his job. But mostly we know each other through the program. So I was able to share with him those things. I was able to share with him, though I didn't want to, that I was envious of people who hadn't done a damn thing to me, and I was resentful, because that was pretty embarrassing. You know, why am I not satisfied enough with myself? And we talked about the exact nature of some of those wrongs that ran through. And then the 6th and 7th step, I find, are ongoing for me. The thing that's most real about the 6th step, became entirely ready to have God remove that, you know, is I got to pause. If I'm not willing to do that God pause, then I'm not entirely ready. Because my initial reaction ain't going to be good. If I'm agitated and doubtful, it's not going to be pretty. Unless I pause and ask my higher power for the right thought or action. And so the 6th step to me is an ongoing thing. Do I take that pause? Am I willing to do it differently? Am I willing? And so I think I do the 6th step, you know, on a daily basis, on an episodic basis. And I think 6 and 7 are tied together. And then we got to 8. And actually, it was on the way to 8, at Early Risers, I say we do a step study. Well, one day, the guy leading the group probably didn't know that we were supposed to do a step, and he did a meeting on fear. And the meeting went on really well, but what happened in that meeting was, I don't know if it's true or not, what her motivation was, but what I was able to see is my friend's sister was named Susie. And I could see that she was losing her younger brother. And I could accept that she was probably fearful about that and was acting out of that fear. Now, I don't know to this day whether she was fearful, but I could see her with eyes of compassion as a human being who was losing someone she loved and was afraid and was not acting her best, just like I don't act my best when I'm fearful. And so that allowed me to, when I got to the 8th step, say, yes, I'm willing to make amends to her. But I couldn't do it when I first started. It was that process of getting to know myself better. And so, but I wasn't going to, we lived in separate towns, luckily, and I could write a letter. And my sponsor had to ask me multiple times, have you written that letter? Well, no, and I had every kind of excuse you could think of. And I finally wrote the letter, and I sent it, and I heard nothing for 2 years. And I'll come back to that in a second, because there's another couple of steps I think I need to get through. The other thing he had me do was I wanted to figure out a way to make amends to my father. Because my father was the person, if you asked me who I blamed for a lot of stuff, I would blame my father. And he became a real convenient foil, right? He was sort of one-dimensional. If I'd had a kinder father, if I'd had a father who didn't rage, if I had a father who didn't drink so much, blah, 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 I would be okay. And it was a way for me not to take responsibility for myself. And the idea he came up with was really beautiful because it worked at multiple levels. He said, sit down and think of the things that your father gave you that are of value to you. And I did. And actually, there were many things. He gave me a love of knowledge, a love of music, a love of animals. And then he said, why don't you call him up and tell him those things? And I did. And that was a very powerful call, because what was going to happen was, how do I tell someone without hurting them all the crappy, mean things and blame I've put on them? I mean, that would be dragging him through my crap. And so this was a way, and I called him and told him those things. I just want to tell you I'm grateful for this, and I went through the list. And it touched him. Not that the amends had to touch him, but what it did for me was it allowed me to see him as a human being and let go of that. All right, just like me, he has good qualities and he has bad qualities, and there are things he gave me of value. And it allowed me to put him so I could have a relationship with him, to mend that relationship. And that was pretty powerful. And I did some other amends. I remember there, I'd stolen some stuff in college from Publix, and I wasn't in Florida, and I called to talk to the manager. This was pretty funny. And I'm like, you know, back in the early 80s, I shoplifted some peanut butter and bread from you guys, and I'd like to make that right. And he's like, I'll have the manager call you back. And they never called me back. He must have thought I was a nut. But I'm like, all right, I'm going to offer. I didn't have a lot of cash register things that I needed to make up for, but that was one of them. Another one that I had worried about for years was when I was little, I had gotten frightened by this bigger kid in the neighborhood. And you know those kind of V-shaped hoes that you weed a garden with? He had cornered me in our garage, and I told him if he came a step closer, I would hit him with that hoe. He did, I did, and the skull has lots of blood vessels in it. Now, my mother assured me that kid didn't die, but in the back of my mind, I thought I had killed him. And so one of the things I did was, I didn't know his name, I didn't know who he was, I had no way of figuring that out, so I just decided I would make a donation to the Michigan Brain Injury Fund to try to deal with that. But that had plagued me for a long time. Then I moved to 10. I still find it, you know, we have this little form in Al-Anon, a daily inventory. You can do it at the end of the day. And I'm really resistant to that form. It's just too much. But I can review my day, and I do review my day. I'm able to admit pretty quickly when I'm wrong, though I still like to wallow in my crap for a little bit. So I remember one time I was really mad at someone, and I was wallowing, and finally it's like 5 minutes later, all right, I've enjoyed that enough. I need to go down and tell him I was wrong, and I was. So the period of wallowing and stuff has gotten much less. And then I came to 11, you know, conscious, thought to improve conscious contact through prayer and meditation, and Scott asked me to be on a panel at an Al-Anon convention on conscious contact. And I said, sure, I'll do it. And then I thought, well, I really better work on conscious contact before I talk about it. Not that I'm not going to talk about things I have no idea about, but so I said, let me do that. And Tom Brady, he has one of Tom Brady's tapes back there. I was listening to a tape of Tom Brady, who was talking to people who were in early recovery, you know, first or second day. And he just took the first two lines of the King James Version of the 23rd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." And I took that to say, "God is my guide, I will be okay." And I could start reflecting on that. And that's sort of the way I developed some conscious contact. There's some prayers in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I use a lot. I need to go back to one. That's the seventh step prayer. And when I finally did that prayer, I offer my Creator, I offer myself to you, the good and the bad, I just broke down in tears because it was like, I'm okay not being perfect. That was that thread of perfection that I was finally being able to let go of, that I can be useful and I don't have to be perfect, that someone can love or care about me if I'm not perfect. And that's another thing, going back to growing up in that family disease of alcoholism, there was always this thought in the back of my mind that everything was black and white, that if someone upset you, you couldn't love them, right? The concept of I can love someone who's upset me is new. That's something I've gained in recovery. I don't have to like everything you do to care about you. But there was this idea in my mind that there could be one thing, and it could be a little minor. So it kept me walking on eggshells, that if I do this, this relationship will end. I don't know what it is, but there's something I can do, because it was sort of conditional love. And so what I've been able to experience in this program and through a higher power is that idea of unconditional love. So one of the things in the 11th step prayers in the back of the Big Book is, when agitated or doubtful, I pray for, ask for the right thought or action. And as an agitated and doubtful person, I get to practice that a lot. So I'd sent the letter, and about 2 years later, my office phone lights up, and her name comes across. And I immediately become very agitated and doubtful, because I thought that water was well past this bridge. And I prayed. I said, "God, give me the right thought or action." And the message that came to me was, "Shut up and listen." And so I answered that phone, and we talked. And I got to listen to her say how much it hurt when her brother died, and I was a friend of hers, or had been a friend of hers, and others had sort of rejected her. And that wasn't easy to listen to. But I didn't defend my, I didn't feel like I had to say, "Well, but if you hadn't done this," or whatever. I could listen to that and ask what I could do to fix that. And she asked me to look for some tapes, and I did. I was not able to find them, but I did. She asked me to look for some tapes of a service that we had done together, a World AIDS Day service, and I was unable to locate them. But that process allowed me to get back in touch with several people I hadn't talked to in years. And then practicing these steps in all our lives, I've found that I can take these principles into my life. Through working the ninth step, I've done the steps twice. There's not a whole lot in the past that there really isn't. I've gotten rid of most of that, but I still worry about the future. You know, I got things. I was telling Scott when I was coming up here yesterday, I'm worried about all this stuff at work, and I finally said, "Okay, I'm going to triage this. What do I have to do before I get in the car to Tennessee, and the rest can wait?" And so, you know, oh yeah, God gives me some tools. I can have some discernment. That has to happen. That has to happen. That has to happen, and that stuff can happen next week. So I was able to do that and come up here. That fear doesn't go away all the time. I mean, when I said it's a daily practice, and I think in the Big Book it says we get a daily reprieve, I think that's true if I'm spiritually fit, if I'm practicing my program. My sister has struggled with alcoholism for years, and she just... I think she's had her year anniversary in March, so she'd now be 13 months sober, which is great. But it was a long, hard process. There were times in that process where I had to say, I'm turning my phone off at night because I'm not going to answer the phone at 5 in the morning and listen, because she would call at night when she was intoxicated and down, and it was just too much. It was like, there's nothing I can do about it. We don't live in the same city, and I don't have to pick up that phone. Doesn't mean I don't love her, but I have a right to get some sleep. And she's sober and doing well, and she lives near us, and she and my partner go to AA meetings together. But I'll tell you how that fear works. In Al-Anon, we call it false evidence appearing real. So about 2 months ago, she was going to come over for dinner, and at a particular time, and she wasn't there. And we texted and we called and we didn't get a response. Well, that just plugged me back into the old patterns. She's turned that phone off. She's disconnected, right? The only thing it is a person has not answered their phone. But here's where my mind goes. She's relapsed. It's over. Even my partner was getting a little bit nervous because it had been a while. You know, and every cylinder I have of fear was firing. And he said, maybe we should go over to her house. And this real quiet voice in me said, no. It is, you don't know enough. And it said, go meditate. And I did. I went into the bedroom and I said, it's too early. I'm not willing to go now. It's too early. We don't know enough about what's going on. And I need to go meditate on this. So I went into my bedroom and was doing a guided meditation. And the phone rang. And I could hear that it was my sister, and everything was fine. So the reality is, she had had a rough day. She went to an AA meeting and turned off her phone. So here's an alcoholic in an AA meeting doing what she should do, and I think the world has come to an end. But that was real for me. I mean, I really, if you asked me what had happened, I could tell you, in my mind. And that's one thing I've learned in recovery, is that my perception and reality are two different things. And I've learned that what you said may not be what I heard, because I hear it with all kinds of filters. And learning that, to ask questions, not to be so sure. I'm going to wrap up a little bit now. A couple things I want to share. One of the things that I've noticed is there's a price that I pay by not living in the present, by not living happy, joyous, and free, by worrying about what's going to happen tomorrow that I have no control over. And that price is I don't get to enjoy where I'm at, right? If my head is where my ass is, I'm going to be pretty good. But my problem is my head is often 4 months out, 3 months out, maybe even 6 hours out. And so I try to be present where I'm at. I know that in the past, on Thursday I went to my partner's nephew's graduation at the University of Alabama at Huntsville, and I had all these things to do, but he really wanted me to go. And I went, and part of what I was able to do was ask my higher power to let me be present, to let me be at that graduation, to let me be at that lunch, to let me be with the people I was at, and not be worrying about all these things that I wasn't doing. And luckily, with God's help, I was able to do that. But there's been a lot of times I've been in a room, but not really there. And I haven't been with the people I'm with. And so my mother, when she died, had a saying, and I read it at her funeral, and it was pretty profound for me. And it goes like this, and I don't mean it in a religious judgment sense, but it says, on Judgment Day, we shall have to account for every permissible thing we could have enjoyed, but did not. And what I view that is, we have so long on this planet. This is the day I've got. And I can either enjoy it, or I can fret and worry about tomorrow or things I did in the past, or I can be present where I'm at. And recovery helps me be present where I'm at. The other thing I wanted to read, and I tried to find in this reader where it was, where I got it from, but I think it was in an Al-Anon reader, but I can't find it. But it's a saying by Marcus Aurelius, who was a philosopher who does appear in this book several times, but not this quote. And it says, "Your days are numbered. Use them to throw open the windows of your soul to the sun. If you do not, the sun will soon set and you with it." And so on a good day, even though I didn't get the sun I wanted, I can try to throw my soul open to the sun. Thank you.